Hello and welcome to today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for Wednesday, November the 29th, 2023. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik, and here's our first story. It's entitled, George Lee to Lead School Board. It's written by Caitlin Yamada of the Sioux City Journal, and Dateline is Sioux City. New Sioux City School Board President Jan George and Vice President Trayla Lee say they want to create an environment of listening and supporting. The pair were elected Monday to lead the board for the next year. George, a retired teacher who joined the board in 2021, was elected president by a 5-2 vote Monday. Lee, the top vote-getter in this month's school board election, was elected vice president by a 4-3 vote. From the time of being diagnosed with a reading disability in elementary school to being told by another teacher that I would only be good enough to work at a packing house, George said, I did not settle for that narrative. George, who previously served as board vice president, said every student, staff member, teacher, administrator, and the board can achieve that goal by learning from each other. Each one of us bring a different skill set that each one of us is going to help move this district forward, so it is that diamond in the Midwest, and it is a destination district, and that's what I've always believed in. I wouldn't have spent 31 years here if I didn't. George, who spent 31 years in K-12 education, taught government at West High School and also coached wrestling before retiring. Currently, he substitute teaches in the district. Dan Greenwell, who served as board president the last 2 years, won re-election in the November 7th election, but opted not to seek another term as president. George and newly elected board member Lance Ehrke both ran for president. Returning board member Bob Michelson, Greenwell, George, and newly elected member John Myers voted for George, while newly elected member Earl Miller and Emick voted for Ehrke. George said he ran for board president because he believes the district and wants to help the district become the best in the state. By watching Greenwell and former board members Pearl, Ellercorn, Flory, Monique Scarlett, Taylor Goodvin serve in leadership roles, George said he learned what it takes to lead the board. As president, I know not everyone will agree with my viewpoint, and that is okay, he said. I have always practiced civil discourse and will continue to do so with open ears and active listening. Everyone's viewpoint needs to be heard and discussed. In the end, the board will come to a consensus, and that will determine the direction of this district. George nominated Lee for vice president. Michelson and Greenwell joined George and Lee in voting for her. Miller, Myers, and Ehrke voted for Ehrke as vice president. Lee, an adoption recruiter, said she is excited about the opportunity and thankful for the community for electing her and the board majority for having confidence in her leadership abilities. My ideas and my goal is to listen, learn, and to understand the operation of our school district while supporting our educators and teachers and children, she said. Lee is following in the footsteps of her mother, Flora Lee, who died in April. Flora Lee served on the Sioux City School Board for 12 years. A former NAACP president, she was the first black woman elected to a local government body in Woodbury County. Lee said her mother laid a great legacy in the community. I am honored and happy to serve in a similar capacity as she did, she said. Even though we're two very different people, the impact that she had on my life as a mother, but furthermore as a community leader, resonates within me, and I am so excited to serve in this capacity. Monday was the first board meeting for the four newly elected board members and the last meeting for outgoing members Philip Hammond, Bernie Scolaro, Goodvin, and Scarlett. Lee, Miller, Myers, and Ehrke and Greenwell took their oaths of office Monday. Next is an article entitled, Taylor Refuses Calls for His Resignation. This is also written by Caitlin Yamada, and the dateline is Sioux City. Jeremy Taylor states he will not resign from his seat on the Woodbury County Board of Supervisors in the wake of his wife's voter fraud conviction last week. Taylor said on Tuesday he plans to complete his term on the board, but did offer to resign from his position as vice chair next week. This will be a distraction, Board Chair Matthew Ung said. He is doing the public a disservice by not stepping down. Last week, a federal judge convicted Taylor's wife, Kim, of 52 counts of voter fraud and government prosecutors say was part of a scheme to stuff the ballot box for her husband, who ran unsuccessfully for Republican nomination for a U.S. House seat in the 2020 primary before winning election to the Board of Supervisors that fall. Three of the five members of the Board of Supervisors, Ung, Mark Nelson, and Dan Bittinger, contacted by the Journal, called on him to voluntarily step aside. The fifth member, Keith Radig, declined to comment. In Iowa, a county elected official can only be removed by a petition filed by the county attorney or the Iowa Attorney General. Taylor's term runs through 2024. The board can vote to remove Taylor from his position as vice chair, but there are only approximately five meetings until the board votes for a new leadership in 2024. Ung called the resignation from vice chair a ceremonial move, but said any move is appropriate given the public sentiment. On Tuesday, the topic of Taylor's seat on the board was brought up during the regular Board of Supervisors meeting. Woodbury County Auditor Pat Gill presented a proposed resolution that would have the board ask the Iowa Attorney General to investigate the voter fraud charges against Taylor and his wife, Kim. If warranted, the Woodbury County Board of Supervisors request the Iowa Attorney General file a petition for removal of Jeremy Taylor from the office of Woodbury County Supervisor, according to the resolution. Taylor took issue with Gill bringing forward a resolution, but the board allowed Gill to continue presenting it. Because it was not included on the agenda, the board was not able to vote or discuss the resolution. Ung said he would review the resolution and seek input from others as well as the county attorney before deciding whether to include it on the agenda next week. Ung said the board is currently in a difficult position and the board members held off on commenting on the situation until it was absolutely set in stone. He said as elected officials, they represent the people of the county. He said people have been reaching out to him concerned about the situation. The thing that has everyone in the community confused and upset is who is taking the fall here. My heart goes out to Kim. My heart goes out to their kids. For instance, there was never a time in my campaigns where I did not know what my wife was doing to help my campaign. It's just simply not something you lose track of, Ung said previously. Taylor declined to make any further comments on the matter outside of stating his intention to stay on the board. Ung said he was surprised to hear that Taylor plans on serving the remainder of his term. I don't know how you can do that when you know that three of your fellow Republican board members have publicly called for you to resign, he said. Bittinger said elected officials have a duty to the citizens to uphold the law and the Constitution while holding each other accountable. In my opinion, any elected official of either political party that would be found in this specific situation should resign due to this compromising position, Bittinger said. Bittinger made additional comments during the supervisors' meeting on Tuesday. He said the issue does not negate any good Taylor has done on the board for the county. He asked that all elected officials be held accountable equally. Nelson previously said those in public offices are expected to have a high level of integrity and responsibility. At a time when so many are questioning the validity of their vote, this type of conduct only deepens the very real concerns amongst our countrymen, he said. While I am deeply disturbed at the actions that have been perpetrated right here in Woodbury County, the future of Mr. Taylor's public service rests squarely with the voters of Woodbury County. Nelson and Radig made no comments during the Tuesday discussion. Two citizens spoke at the supervisors' meeting regarding the issue. Doyle Turner said he felt the matter should be left up to the voters of Woodbury County. Taylor represents 20% of the county, and nobody should attempt to usurp the vote of the 20% of the population of this county, he said. This is what elections are for. Elections decide these type of things. Craig Levine said he has a problem with Taylor and said he had to know what his wife was doing. If you had any dignity, you would step down, he said. Kim Taylor was convicted on November the 21st of 26 counts of providing false information in registering and voting, 23 counts of fraudulent voting, and 3 counts of fraudulent registration. Throughout the six-day trial, prosecutors said that in the year 2020, Taylor, who was born in Vietnam, made contact with a number of Vietnamese voters with limited English language comprehension and filled out and signed voting forms and ballots for them and their English-speaking children in an attempt to stuff the ballot box for her husband. Prosecutors identified Jeremy Taylor as an unindicted co-conspirator in his wife's trial, but he has not been charged. Assistant U.S. Attorney Ron Timmons, who was one of three prosecutors to present the federal government's case against Kim Taylor, declined to comment on any potential future indictments. The case is still under investigation. Taylor, the county supervisor from District 5, previously represented District 2, winning 2 4-year terms. But he was forced to give up that seat in January of 2020 after a local voter challenged his residency in the district. After weighing testimony and evidence in the case, Woodbury County Auditor Pat Gill revoked Taylor's voter registration, ruling his primary residence was a home outside the district on Christie Road rather than a home on Grandview Boulevard where Taylor claimed he lived. After Taylor lost his bid in 2020 for the Republican nomination for the Iowa 4th Congressional District in June primary voting, he was selected in August by a special Republican county panel to be the county party's nominee for District 3 supervisor. The Republican unseated Democratic incumbent Marty Potterbaum by nearly 5,000 votes in the November general election. Argument at party escalated to two fatal shootings. Tuesday marked first day of testimony in murder trial. This is written by Nick Hytrek of the Sioux City Journal, and the dateline is Sioux City. For much of the night, the party at Quiana Luis's homes was like previous gatherings. The 10 or 12 friends in the house talked, drank beer and other alcohol, listened to music, and showed off guns. At one point, Luis took a photo of five men, each posing with a handgun. Everyone was getting along, Luis testified Tuesday, until he heard Joseph Cruz and Carlos Aguirre arguing while she was in her bedroom, changing clothes. She didn't know what they were arguing about, but the dispute became physical and the two men exchanged punches. Carlos pulled a gun out. I heard it cock back and he was pointing it at the ground, Luis said. Though she admitted she'd had a lot to drink that night, Luis said she remembered seeing Cruz scuffling with Aguirre, attempting to take the gun from him and eventually succeeding. All I remember is the shots going off. He, Cruz, fired off multiple shots with it, Luis said. Luis hit the floor after seeing Aguirre appear to be ducking and going to the floor. When she looked up, Anthony Williams was lying next to her with a gunshot wound in his chest. Aguirre was across the kitchen, a gunshot wound in his head. I knew he was dead, Luis said, crying, saying she didn't see Cruz after the shots were fired. Cruz, age 20, of Sioux City, is standing trial in Woodbury County District Court on two counts of second-degree murder for the October 29, 2022 shooting deaths of his cousin Williams, age 19, and Aguirre, age 21, in the early morning hours at 1421 West 5th Street. The charges are Class B felonies that carry 50-year prison sentences. On the opening day of trial testimony, Woodbury County Attorney James Loomis told jurors during his opening statement Cruz and Aguirre had been arguing over the ownership of a handgun Aguirre had brought to the party. As they scuffled with each other for possession of the gun, it discharged, the shot striking Cruz in the leg before he was able to take the weapon from Aguirre. Once he got possession of that gun, he ends up shooting Carlos in the back of the head and in the back. His cousin, Anthony Williams, who was standing nearby, is shot in the chest, Loomis said. The defendant did not shoot Carlos Aguirre in self-defense, but it was with a fixed purpose to do him harm. He was angry. Cruz's attorney, Michael Jacobsma, told jurors about the fight during his opening statement, but said after Cruz had been shot and gained possession of the gun, Aguirre continued at him, his head and shoulders lowered. Cruz pointed the gun in a downward direction, Jacobsma said, and fired, striking Aguirre. A Williams was shot in the scuffle to get the gun. A tragedy occurred, but Joseph acted in self-defense, Jacobsma said. Tragedy does not equal a crime. the state will be able to prove to you a tragedy occurred a little over a year ago, but it won't be able to prove to you a crime occurred. Aguirre died at the scene, and Williams was pronounced dead at Mercy One Siouxland Medical Center. Luis's sister, Quiley Luis, had moved into the house shared by her sister and their cousin Sarah Zavala that day. Quiley Lewis said she was not drinking that night and hadn't seen any guns in the house before she went to bed around midnight. "I woke up to gunshots," she said. "Two gunshots woke her," she said, "and she heard two more after rolling out of bed and onto the floor. After the shooting stopped, she entered the kitchen and saw Aguirre and Williams on the floor. Cruz was standing in the living room. I asked him what happened, and he shrugged his shoulders and turned around and walked out the door," Quiley Luis said. Luis said she didn't know where Cruz went after leaving. She stayed in the house until police arrived. Police collected five spent shell casings found near the bodies and spent bullets found inside the house. They later found four guns in a bag in a car parked outside Cruz's home. Michael Tate, an Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation firearms expert, testified that all five casings found at the scene matched those from test rounds he fired from a Shadow Systems semi-automatic handgun Sioux City investigators submitted to him. Tests on the bullets were inconclusive and could have been fired from a gun made by a long list of manufacturers, including Shadow Systems, he said. Our next article is entitled, "No Link Between Traffic Stop and Missing Man." This is written by Dolly Butts of the Sioux City Journal, and the dateline is Sioux City. The Woodbury County Sheriff's Office said in a social media post that there is no evidence or indication that a Monday traffic stop is connected to a missing Wall Lake, Iowa truck driver. The Sheriff's Office made the announcement on its Facebook account Monday evening in response to information circulating on social media about a traffic stop near Highway 20 and the bypass and the disappearance of 53-year-old David Schultz. Schultz was last heard from in the early morning hours of November the 21st, according to the Lakeview Police Department. The department and the Sac County Sheriff's Office began an investigation into Schultz's whereabouts the afternoon of November the 21st. At 1:01 a.m. Monday, the Woodbury County Communications Center received a 911 call concerning a reckless driver near Moville. Deputies conducted a routine traffic stop on the vehicle at 1:18 a.m. The driver was subsequently arrested for possession of cocaine and felon in possession of a firearm. There were two other adults and four children also in the vehicle at the time of the arrest. There is no evidence or indication that this traffic stop has any connection to the missing driver referred to in the post, the sheriff's office said. The suspect's nationality has nothing to do with the case, and all suspects are presumed innocent until proven guilty in a court of law. The sheriff's office noted the caller did the right thing by calling in suspicious or reckless activity. Over the weekend, volunteers searched for Schultz in Wright, Webster, Calhoun, and Sac County. The search continued Monday. So far, nothing has been found. Sarah Schultz, Schultz's wife, told the Journal his red truck was found the afternoon of November the 21st, northeast of Sac City. It was parked on northbound Highway 71, about 5 miles north of the old Highway 20 intersection. She said the vehicle was turned off, but it wasn't pulled over to the side of the road. The trailer was still loaded with young pigs. The truck was pointing the wrong direction from where Schultz was headed, north rather than south. There was no sign of David, but Sarah Schultz said his coat was located in a ditch on the opposite side of the road. The Iowa Division of Criminal Investigations is assisting the Sac County Sheriff's Office and the Lakeview Police Department in this investigation. The United Cajun Navy, a nonprofit organization that organizes search and rescue teams, has been involved in the searches. Northeast Sac County property owners have been asked to check their property and outbuildings for anything out of the ordinary. The Lakeview Police Department has asked anyone who has seen or heard from Schultz to contact them at area code 712-657-2513. Now here's an article from the Nation and World page, and it's entitled, "More Prisoners Go Home. Mediators Gather in Qatar to Try to Extend Temporary Ceasefire." This is written by Wafa Sharafa, Jack Jeffrey, and Lee Keith of the Associated Press, and the dateline is Deir al-Balah, Gaza Strip. A fragile truce between Israel and Hamas held for a fifth day Tuesday as international mediators in Qatar worked to extend it and more hostages were freed from Gaza. Israel came under pressure from the United States to better protect Palestinian civilians in Gaza if it follows through on its promise to resume the war. Israel released 30 Palestinian prisoners on the fifth day of its temporary ceasefire with Hamas. Earlier Tuesday, Hamas released 12 hostages the militant group held captive since October the 7th. Mediators met in Qatar to try to extend the ceasefire beyond Wednesday. For the first time since it began, Israel and Hamas traded accusations of a serious violation with an exchange of fire between troops and militants in northern Gaza. But there was no indication that it would endanger the truce or the planned exchanges of hostages held in Gaza for Palestinians imprisoned in Israel. Israel has vowed to resume the war with full force to destroy Hamas once it's clear that no more hostages will be freed under the deal. The Biden administration told Israel it must avoid significant further displacement and mass casualties among Palestinian civilians if it resumes the offensive, and must operate with more precision in southern Gaza than it has in the north, according to U.S. officials. The officials spoke on condition of anonymity under ground rules set by the White House. CIA Director William Burns and David Barnea, who heads Israel's Mossad intelligence agency, were in Qatar, a key mediator with Hamas, to discuss extending the ceasefire and releasing more hostages. A diplomat said on condition of anonymity. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is set to visit the region this week, also with an eye to extending the truce. Hamas and other militants are still holding about 160 hostages out of the 240 seized in their October the 7th assault into southern Israel that ignited the war. Israel said it is willing to extend the ceasefire by one day for every 10 additional hostages that Hamas releases, according to the deal brokered by the Qatar, Egypt, and U.S. Hamas is expected to make much higher demands for release of captive soldiers. Israel has vowed to end Hamas's 16-year rule in Gaza and crush its military capabilities. That would almost certainly require expanding the ground offensive from northern Gaza to the south, where most of Gaza's population of 2.3 million is now crowded. Next, from India, construction workers rescued. Massive operation has a happy ending for crew trapped in tunnel. This comes from the Associated Press and the Dateline is Uttarkashi, India. 41 construction workers emerged dazed and smiling Tuesday from a collapsed tunnel in northern India where they spent the last 17 days, a happy ending to an ordeal that gripped the country and led to a massive rescue operation that overcame several setbacks. Locals, relatives, and government officials erupted in joy, set off firecrackers, and shouted, Bharat Mata Ki Jai, Hindi for Long Live Mother India, as happy workers walked out after receiving a brief checkup by doctors. Officials hung garlands around their necks as the crowd cheered. Nitin Gadkari, the country's Minister of Road Transport and Highways, said in a video posted on social media that he was completely relieved and happy that all of the workers were rescued from the Silkyara Tunnel in Uttarkashi, a town in India's northern state of Uttarakhand. This was a well-coordinated effort by multiple agencies, marking one of the most significant rescue operations in recent years, Gadkari said. No one was seriously injured or killed when a landslide caused a section of the 2.4-mile tunnel about 220 yards from the entrance to collapse early on the morning of November the 12th. The workers were finishing their shifts and many were looking forward to celebrating Diwali, the Hindu festival of lights, that day. The workers had light in their collapsed tunnel, and since early in their ordeal they were provided with food, water, and oxygen through pipes. More than a dozen doctors, including psychiatrists, were also at the site monitoring their health. Officials said all 41 workers made it through the ordeal in good health. Before emerging to the cameras and crowds and being whisked away in ambulances, each was given a checkup at a makeshift medical camp in the tunnel entrance. The rescue was originally expected to last only a few days, but a series of setbacks led to its expansion and to the workers being trapped for more than 2 weeks. The workers were extracted one by one on a wheeled stretcher that was pulled through a yard-wide tunnel of welded pipes that crews pushed through the dugout space. Most of the workers were migrant laborers from throughout the country. Family and friends gathered to honor Rosalind Carter. Jimmy Carter, age 99, now in hospice, makes a rare public appearance. This comes from the Associated Press, and the dateline is Atlanta. Rosalind Carter was memorialized Tuesday as a matriarch who felt most comfortable among the impoverished and vulnerable as she was mourned by a rare gathering of all living U.S. First Ladies and multiple presidents, including her 99-year-old husband, Jimmy Carter, in the front row. The tribute service marked the second day of a 3-day schedule of public events celebrating the former First Lady and global humanitarian who died November the 19th at home in Plains, Georgia at the age of 96. Tributes began Monday in the Carters' native Sumter County. My mother was the glue that held our family together through the ups and downs and thicks and thins of our family's politics, her son James Earl Chip Carter III said. The former president, who was 10 months into home hospice care and hadn't been seen in public since September, watched from his wheelchair, reclining and covered by a blanket featuring his wife's face, with Chip and his daughter Amy holding his hands. Their other son, Jeff and Jack, flanked them. "He never wants to be very far from her," Carter Center CEO Paige Alexander said. Hunter Biden offers to publicly testify to panel. GOP leadership wants deposition to happen behind closed doors. This also comes from the Associated Press, and the dateline is Washington. Hunter Biden offered Tuesday to testify publicly before Congress, striking a defiant note in response to a subpoena from Republicans and setting up a potential high-stakes face-off even as a separate special counsel probe unfolds and his father, President Joe Biden, campaigns for re-election. The Democratic president's son slammed the subpoena's request for closed-door testimony, saying it can be manipulated. Representative James Comer of Kentucky, the chairman of the House Oversight Committee, stood firm, saying Republicans expect full cooperation with their original demand for a deposition. Hunter Biden's lawyer called the inquiry a fishing expedition, a response in line with the more forceful legal approach he's taken in recent months as congressional Republicans pursue an impeachment inquiry seeking to tie his father to his business dealings. Republicans so far failed to uncover evidence directly implicating President Biden in wrongdoing. Comer said Tuesday the president's son could testify publicly in the future, but he expects him to sit for depositions on December the 13th as outlined in the subpoena. Now, some shorter articles under the digest heading. Official indicates Fed could start cutting rates. Dateline, Washington. A key Federal Reserve official raised the possibility Tuesday that the Fed could decide to cut its benchmark interest rate as early as spring if inflation keeps declining steadily. Christopher Waller, a member of the Fed's Board of Governors, cautioned that inflation is still too high and that it's not yet certain if a recent slowdown in price increases can be sustained. Still, in remarks at the American Enterprise Institute, a Washington, D.C.-based think tank, he sounded the most optimistic notes of any Fed official since the central bank launched its aggressive rate hikes in March of 2022 and signaled the central bank is likely done raising rates. Waller is regarded as a reactively hawkish official, meaning he typically favors higher rates to combat inflation rather than low rates to boost job growth. He is somewhat of a bellwether for the Fed's overall rate-setting committee. Next, both parties move to force vote on Santos, also a dateline of Washington. House lawmakers from both parties moved Tuesday to force a vote this week on the expulsion of Representative George Santos, a New York Republican who was the subject of a scathing ethics investigation report released this month that found he stole from his campaign and deceived donors. Santos responded to the competing expulsion resolutions by taking to the House floor and asking colleagues to understand what kind of precedent it would set for him to be removed before nearly 24 federal charges against him are resolved. He made clear that he would not resign beforehand. This expulsion vote simply undermines and underscores the precedent that we've had in this chamber, Santos said. It starts and puts us in a new direction, a dangerous one. In the Ukraine war, the wife of Ukraine's intelligence chief was diagnosed with heavy metals poisoning and is being treated in a hospital, a spokesperson for the agency said Tuesday as the country's war with Russia stretched into its 22nd month. When Deutsche Bank loaned Donald Trump's company hundreds of millions of dollars, the bank followed its own guidelines that include checking out information that would-be borrowers provide. An executive testified Tuesday at the former president's civil fraud trial. Argentina's right-wing president-elect Javier Milei met Tuesday with senior Biden administration officials at the White House in his first international trip since winning a runoff election earlier this month. And Americans for Prosperity, the political arm of the powerful Koch network, formally endorsed Nikki Haley as presidential campaign on Tuesday, promising to help her defeat former President Donald Trump in the GOP primary contest. Federal mediators rejected a union request that could have cleared the way for a strike by flight attendants at American Airlines. The National Mediation Board directed the airline and the Association of Professional Flight Attendants to keep negotiating over a new contract. And members of the Paris-based Bureau International des Expositions chose Saudi Arabia's capital, Riyadh, on Tuesday to host the 2030 World Expo following its bid that focused on shaping a prosperous and sustainable future. You're listening to the Sioux City Journal on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, please give us a call at area code 515-243-6833. Next is an article entitled, Murder Case Slowly Moves Forward. Suspect claims in alibi he was driving around alone at night. This is written by Kevin Fixler and Sean Goodwin of the Idaho Statesman. In the days immediately following the tragedy that stole four University of Idaho students' lives about a year ago, memorials made up of flowers and mementos symbolizing the victims spontaneously surfaced throughout a mournful Moscow, Idaho. Hosting one was the driveway at the site of the homicides, a home on King Road with distinctive architecture that quickly became recognizable nationally. Another took hold on the slender wooden tables outside the Mad Greek restaurant downtown where two of the students worked. For months, tall white candles dedicated to each of the four victims, Maddie, Kaylee, Zanna, and Ethan, became a constant among other items left behind in tribute. The eternal flames kept their memories alive, reminding passers-by of the lost lives. On a night in mid-January, Isla Lester, a server at the Greek restaurant, took a few moments between customers to scrawl out the letters K-A-Y-L-E-E in orange marker on the side of a fresh candle. She brought it outside to join three others already lit in remembrance. A help wanted sign hung in the window. By August, 9 months later after the killings, the candles were gone. Inside the restaurant late last month, beside a frame with now familiar photos of the four students, a sign told patrons, "Believe there is good in the world." A year after the students' deaths, Brian Kohlberger, the man charged with their murders, remains in custody, but the case is largely unresolved without a trial date awaiting closure sought by victims' families. Here's a look at where the case stands. Kohlberg is facing four murder charges. Kohlberger, age 28, faces four first-degree murder charges and a count of felony burglary in the November 13, 2022 deaths of University of Idaho students Madison Mogan and Kaylee Goncalves, both 21, and Zanna Kernodal and Ethan Chapin, both 20. At the time, Kohlberger was a graduate student at Washington State University in Pullman, Washington, about 9 miles west of Moscow. Kohlberger was arrested in late December in eastern Pennsylvania in connection with the fatal stabbings. His arrest ended a nearly 7-week manhunt that garnered attention nationwide. 4 days later, in early January, Kohlberger agreed to travel to Idaho to face the charges. He made his first appearance in the Lata County Courthouse on January 5th. A preliminary hearing was scheduled for June, but it was canceled after a grand jury instead indicted him in May. Koberger was arraigned the following week, where Judge entered a not guilty plea on his behalf. Judge of Idaho's 2nd Judicial District in Lata County chose to maintain a prior gag order issued by a magistrate judge. Attorneys for the prosecution, defense, witnesses, and the victims' families are not allowed to speak about the case outside of court filings. As defined agents of the prosecution, members of law enforcement also are restricted from talking about their investigation. Trial proceedings postponed indefinitely. Koberger last appeared for a court hearing in early November. Judge provided prosecutors and his public defense team an update after initially ruling that the defense deserved to receive at least some of the DNA records produced by the FBI that helped investigators land on their client as the suspect. Judge set a deadline of December the 1st for FBI to turn over its records to prosecutors. From there, he'll review the records and make a final decision about which ones must be turned over to the defense through the legal process known as discovery. Koberger's murder trial was indefinitely postponed after he waived his right in August for it to begin within 6 months of the entry of a plea. His trial was originally scheduled to start the first week of October. Prosecutors already have stated their intent to seek the death penalty for Koberger if he is convicted by a jury. Idaho is one of 24 U.S. states that maintain active capital punishment. Koberger alibi? He went on a drive alone. In early August, the defense filed Koberger's alibi. They stated that their client had a habit of going for drives alone and that often he would go for drives at night. The defense said Koberger was on one of these drives on the night of the killings last year, late November the 12th into November the 13th, and that there was no specific witnesses to say where Koberger was at the time of the killings. "We knew that already, and if that's his alibi, so be it," Lata County Prosecutor Bill Thompson said in court in August. "We will accept what the defendant has said he was driving around, with the stipulation that he cannot provide more about it later at trial," he said. Koberger previously declined to provide a pretrial alibi after the state requested one, with his defense saying that the motion to provide an alibi was an attempt by the state to force the defense to open its work product files and let the state peek inside. Koberger's defense said the alibi filed regarding Koberger's driving habits is the only one that can be firmly stated for now. Cameras in the courtroom not allowed. Judge is banning members of the media and the public from using cameras and audio recording devices in the courtroom, saying they jeopardize the defendant's right to a fair trial. He said the court would, however, operate a live stream available on its YouTube channel that would ensure members of the public can observe the proceedings. The judge had been allowing news cameras in the courtroom during hearings under strict conditions, but granted a request by Koberger's attorneys to ban them. Judge wrote that some photographic and video coverage had zoomed in on Koberger despite his directive that shots show the entire courtroom, and that some shots depicted him entering or exiting the courtroom despite orders that images only be taken when court is on the record and not in recess. University of Idaho plans home demolition. The university initially planned to demolish the house on King Road where the four students were killed after it was donated to the school by its previous owner. The U of I planned to raise the house by the start of the fall semester in August, but after two postponements, there's still no set date for its demolition. University spokesperson Jody Walker told the Statesman that the school will hold off until at least the end of the fall semester, which concludes in mid-December. The latest delay allowed the FBI and prosecutors to return to the King Road house in early November for more documentation to construct visual and audio exhibits and a physical model of the home, the university said in a news release. Now it's time to turn to sports, and we'll start off with this college football article that's entitled "Loaded Field Fuels Weekend Drama." It's written by Ralph D. Russo of the Associated Press. The four-team college football playoff is going out with the most crowded field of contenders and the most consequential championship weekend in the 10-year history of the system. 8 teams have at least a glimmer of hope to make the field. Yes, that means you too, Ohio State. The penultimate CFP rankings were released Tuesday. Georgia remained number 1. Michigan moved up a spot to 2nd after beating Ohio State. Unbeaten Washington was 3rd, followed by unbeaten Florida State. Oregon remained 5th. Ohio State slipped to number 6. Texas was 7th and Alabama 8th. The field for the playoff will be announced Sunday. Determining which teams are CFP contenders heading into championship weekend is a bit subjective. More often than not, a Power 5 team with only one loss going into the conference title games, regardless of whether that team is playing, has to be considered alive. No team with 2 losses has ever made the CFP, but at least a couple of times a team with 2 losses had to be considered in contention when it played for a conference title. Auburn in 2017 is the most obvious example. That season was one of the few where championship weekend had multiple games matching CFP contenders. More commonly, championship weekend hasn't been about teams playing their way into the field as much as watching for whether teams might play their way out. Last season, when Southern California lost the Pac-12 championship game on Friday night, the field was practically set before Saturday's games kicked off. Georgia and Michigan won their conferences to stay perfect and lock down the top 2 seeds, but would have gotten in regardless. TCU lost the Big 12 title game and got in. Ohio State slipped in the back door without playing. Alabama coach Nick Saban politicked for the Tide to get in with 2 losses, but there was no real drama heading into the selection Sunday. This year, every conference championship has at least 1 CFP contender. The Pac-12 and the SEC each have 2. 2-time defending champion Georgia might be able to lose to Alabama and make the field, as it did on the way to the national title in 2021, but that is far from a guarantee. There are multiple scenarios that could play out this weekend and leave the 13-member CFP selection committee facing almost impossible choices Saturday night. With such strong teams on top of college football this season, it would seem to be a perfect time to have a 12-team playoff to accommodate them all. That's coming next year. Though an argument could be made if there were more seasons like this that produced dramatic championship weekends and intrigue heading into the selection Sunday, maybe the CFP would not have needed to expand. In college basketball, Shepherd, Kentucky overwhelm Miami. Reed Shepherd scored 21 points, including 13 during a second half in which Kentucky shot 67%, and Antonio Reeves added 18 to propel the 12th-ranked Wildcats to a 95-73 blowout of number 8 Miami on Tuesday night in the ACC-SEC Challenge. Shepherd came off the bench, drained a 3 for his first basket, and finished 5 of 9 from long range and 8 of 13 overall. Reeves was 7 of 12 from the field. Trey Mitchell had 14 points and 7 assists, and Rob Dillingham scored 14 points. Justin Edwards had 11 points for Kentucky. Norchard Omir scored 20 points, and Wuga Poplar had 19 for the Hurricanes, who shot 44.1% from the field, but were no match for Kentucky's nearly flawless offensive performance. The Wildcats made their final 3 shots to lead 42-37 at halftime before sinking their first 6 of the second half and 10 of 11 overall for a 67-43 advantage with 14 minutes and 15 seconds remaining in the game. Kentucky ended up converting 20 of 30 after halftime and 37 of 62 overall for 59.7% to dominate a matchup between the 2 of the country's highest scoring teams. Kentucky led by as much as 29 points and finished 9 of 21 from three-point range. In other college basketball games, number 1 Purdue beat Texas Southern 99-67. Number 3 Marquette beat Southern 93-56. Number 5 Kansas beat Eastern Illinois 71-63. Number 9 Baylor beat Nichols 108-70. Number 11 Gonzaga beat Cal State Bakersfield 81-65. Georgia Tech beat number 21 Mississippi State 67-59. Clemson beat number 23 Alabama 85-77. Here's some NFL notes. Peppers Gates reach semifinals for Hall of Fame. Three-time All-Pros Julius Peppers and Antonio Gates were chosen as semifinalists for the Pro Football Hall of Fame's Class of 2024 in their first year of eligibility. Peppers and Gates headlined a group of 25 modern-day semifinalists announced Tuesday by the Hall of Fame from a group of 173 nominees announced in September. The only other player who advanced to the semifinal stage for the first time was running back Tiki Barber. Eight players who made it to the final stage of 15 in the class of 2023 return as semifinalists this year, with Jared Allen, Dwight Freeney, Devin Hester, Andre Johnson, Torrey Holt, Patrick Willis, Willie Anderson, and Darren Woodson all looking to get in after falling short a year ago. The other semifinalists are Eric Allen and Anquan Boldin, Jahari Evans, London Fletcher, Eddie George, James Harrison, Rodney Harrison, Robert Mathis, Steve Smith Sr., Fred Taylor, Hines Ward, Ricky Waters, Reggie Wayne, and Vince Wilfork. The 25 semifinalists will be reduced to 15 finalists before the final voting process in January. The 15 finalists will be trimmed to 10 and then 5 during the selection meeting early next year. The final five candidates will need to get 80% of the votes from the panel to get into the hall. Four finalists previously announced are Buddy Parker in the coaching category and Randy Grandishar, Steve McMichael, and Art Powell in the senior category. They also will get in if they get support from at least 80% of voters. From the Minnesota Vikings, All-Pro wide receiver Justin Jefferson was activated from injured reserve on Tuesday, clearing him to return to action after missing 2 months with a hamstring injury. Minnesota began its bye week after a 12-10 loss to Chicago on Monday, but Jefferson will be back on the field when the Vikings play at Las Vegas on December the 10th. And Indianapolis Colts running back Jonathan Taylor will have some thumb surgery on Wednesday and hopes to return to Indianapolis in about 3 weeks, according to an AP source. Taylor apparently was injured during Sunday's 27-20 victory over Tampa Bay, but finished the game with 15 carries for 91 yards and a season-high 2 touchdowns. Zach Moss is expected to replace Taylor at Tennessee. In professional golf, Woods more optimistic about his game than Saudi deal. This comes from Doug Ferguson of the Associated Press. Tiger Woods sounded more optimistic about playing golf next year than he did about the PGA Tour finalizing a deal with Saudi Arabia or private investors by the end of the year. Woods addressed reporters Tuesday for the first time in nearly 8 months, and so much has happened since then. Fusion surgery on his right ankle that kept him out of golf, the PGA Tour's shocking agreement with the backers of LIV Golf, and his decision to join the PGA Tour board for the first time in his career. He is playing the Hero World Challenge, his holiday event in the Bahamas for 20 top players. Woods said his ankle, but not the rest of his body, is pain-free and even suggested he hopes that he can play once a month next year, starting with the Genesis Invitational at Riviera. Woods was most candid about his frustration that he and other players were blindsided by the secret negotiations by PGA Tour Commissioner Jay Monahan and two high-profile board members that led to the agreement announced June the 6th with the Public Investment Fund of Saudi Arabia. "We were very frustrated with what happened, and we took steps going forward to ensure that the player involvement, we were not going to be left out of the process like we were," he said. "So part of that process was putting me on the board and accepting that position." He also expressed faith in Monahan as one reason he agreed to join the board, what he can do going forward and what can't happen again. He was far more vague on details, not surprising since the board negotiations are private. Woods only said there were options, a lot of moving parts, and that all sides were working aggressively toward finalizing a deal. "All the parties are talking, and we're aggressively working on trying to get a deal done," he said. "We're all trying to make sure that the process is better, too. So the implementation of governance is one of the main topics, along with getting the deal done, but making sure it's done the right way." In the NBA, Bucks advanced to quarterfinals after rallying past Heat 131-124. The Milwaukee Bucks rallied in the fourth quarter to beat the Miami Heat 131-124 on Tuesday night and clinch a home quarterfinal game in the NBA in-season tournament. Chris Middleton scored 17 and Malik Beasley scored 16 for the Bucks, who won East Group B with a 4-0 record. They'll host wildcard New York on either December 4th or 5th, with East Group C winner Boston going to Group A winner Indiana for the other quarterfinal before the Final Four in Las Vegas. Bam Adebayo scored 31 points for the Heat, who got 21 from Kyle Lowry and 20 from Josh Richardson. In other NBA games, Knicks 115, Hornets 91. Julius Randle had 25 points and 20 rebounds. R.J. Barrett scored 16, and New York advanced to the quarterfinals as a wild card with a victory over visiting Charlotte. The Knicks missed their chance to win East Group B when the Bucks beat the Heat. Celtics 124, Bulls 97. Jaylen Brown scored 30 points, Jason Tatum had 21, and Boston routed visiting Chicago in the final round of group play. The Celtics won a three-team tiebreaker with Orlando and Brooklyn via point differential to take Group C and the number 3 seed in the East. Mavericks 119, Rockets 115. Luka Doncic had 41 points, 9 rebounds, and 9 assists, and Dallas rallied from a 9-point deficit in the third to prevent visiting Houston from advancing to the quarterfinals. The Mavericks' win allowed New Orleans to clinch West Group B. Cavaliers 128, Hawks 105. Donovan Mitchell scored 40 points, Evan Mobley added 17, and a career-high 19 rebounds, and Cleveland completed pool play with a win over visiting Atlanta. The Cavaliers failed to advance in the tournament. Timberwolves 106, Thunder 103. Rudy Gobert had 17 points and 16 rebounds and 4 blocks, and Minnesota withstood an injury to Anthony Edwards to beat visiting Oklahoma City. Nets 115, Raptors 103. Spencer Dinwiddie scored 23 points. Mikal Bridges added 22, and Brooklyn beat visiting Toronto to win its third straight game, but the Nets were knocked out of the tournament. And Kings 124, Warriors 123. Malik Monk hit the game winner with 7.1 seconds to play. De'Aaron Fox had 29 points, and host Sacramento rallied to beat Golden State and earn a place in the quarterfinals. Here's some scores from around the NHL. Toronto Maple Leafs beat the Florida Panthers 2-1 on Tuesday night. The Devils beat the Islanders 5-4. Hurricanes beat the Flyers 4-1. Predators 3, Penguins 2 in overtime. Minnesota Wild defeated the St. Louis Blues 3-1. The Stars 2, Jets 0. Blackhawks 4, Kraken 3. Coyotes beat the Lightning 3-1. Oilers 5, Golden Knights 4 in a shootout. And the Canucks defeated the Ducks 3-1. From around the NHL, Kane signing with Red Wings. Patrick Kane is joining the Detroit Red Wings for the rest of the season, choosing the championship-rich franchise over other suitors for the 4-time All-Star's return to the NHL from hip surgery. He signed a contract Tuesday worth a prorated $2.75 million, meaning he'll make just over $2 million through mid-April. Kane, who turned age 35 on November the 19th, was an unrestricted free agent rehabbing from hip resurfacing surgery in June. He has been skating since August and told the Associated Press in September that he was starting to feel like his old self again. The three-time Stanley Cup champion is joining his third original six team after the Chicago Blackhawks and New York Rangers. Kane is attempting to become the third player to come back from the invasive hip operation following Ed Jovanovski and Nicholas Backstrom. Now we'll return to articles from the Dear Amy column, and the first article is entitled, Retirees Bounce Back from Major Whoopsie. Dear Amy, my husband and I retired to a wonderful southwestern city. Our two adult children are married and live in other parts of the country. They each have young children. During the pandemic, my son, daughter-in-law, and baby granddaughter in Florida were alone with no nearby relatives, as were we. After the pandemic, we decided that we should move to Florida to help them out, and in turn, they would be there for us as we aged. They were also excited and encouraged us to purchase a home near them. We bought a home over FaceTime, sold our other home, quit our local clubs and activities, and moved. We quickly realized we had made a mistake and that we didn't like living in Florida. We assumed we would become an integral part of our kids' lives, but their expectations were totally different. We only babysat twice in 6 months. After 6 months, we moved back to the Southwest. We are now working to resume our old lives, but my daughter-in-law no longer calls us or participates in calls to any extent. I know we made a hasty decision that has resulted in hurt and bad feelings. I also know that our expectations were unrealistic. However, I would love to resume a relationship with my daughter-in-law. Our son is very cordial and generally eager to put our granddaughter on FaceTime with us. I'm reluctant to phone my daughter-in-law directly. I don't want to make matters worse. We must not be the only people afflicted with pandemic panic who made hasty decisions. Your thoughts? Signed, Regretful. Dear Regretful, people make mistakes. People make blunders. Yours seem to have been a bit of a doozy, but you obviously have the means to undo this choice. Your about face also seems to have occurred at warp speed. It was a quick whoopsie, we're out. Surely you can imagine how bewildered your son and his wife might be about your recent behavior. Write your daughter-in-law a letter or email. Own your embarrassment and apologize for the impact of your choices on them. Say we are at a point in our own lives where we are just trying our hardest to do what is best for us. I think the experience during the pandemic made us panic and we were too hasty in our decision to move to Florida. We're resettled and happy, but I'm embarrassed and upset by the impact our choice has made on you. I know we made a hasty decision that has resulted in hurt feelings. We love you and we really want to make this right, so I hope you can forgive us. I really miss our contact with you. I hope you will communicate with us when you feel ready. You can express your feelings or frustration, and we will listen. That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Sioux City Journal. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.